Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Zombie Myths of Australian Military History by Craig Stockings. We've done a series of what's quite actually painful myths, or as an Australian, to read through. They're painful in that you may have had, or myself may have had, a level of scepticism, but that's not shared by the general population. And indeed, it makes us look rather foolish as a country. So we've done the World War One myths of Australia not being defeated at the start, which of course all the Allies got defeated at the start of the war, and Australia winning World War One, just putting fairly bluntly here. And then the myth and propaganda that was in World War One, so World War Two, taking a life of its own and actually getting into the mainstream consciousness of World War Two propaganda, actually going through. Perhaps other countries have this belief, but it's really inexcusable in Australia, where we've got educated people and people can talk about things and stuff like that. But there indeed they do write books. Now, this chapter six, is Out in the Midday Sun, The Loss of the HMS Sydney 2. We had really our first major battleship of World War One, was the HMS Sydney 1, or it wasn't called the Sydney 1 because we didn't know there was going to be seconds. I think it's the third and fourth HMS Sydney. It's named like that. But the first one had an engagement with a German battleship in the Indian Ocean, and it sunk the German battleship, and there was great great elation. Sorry, you Germans, but that was the basic things. In fact, it's one of the more entertaining or amazing things to read about the various German battleships in World War One, because they used to cruise around to remote islands, which just had no idea that the Germans were at war with Australia, and the Australians would help load up these German battleships because they were just so remote. They had no idea that World War One was even going on. So the Germans would come along and get coal, and they'd ask questions about, you know, what exactly are you doing? Why are all those other ships out there? Oh, we're just looking after them. And of course, they were looking after merchant ships that captured and were escorting or even scuttling eventually. So there's a lot of interest there. So the HMS Sydney 2 was the next big version, and I think it was a celebrated ship. It had fought in the Mediterranean, had a few victories there. It came across and just rolled up to a much smaller German ship, which had anti-tank guns. So it didn't actually have proper naval guns, as far as I understood. But there were rapid-fire anti-tank aircraft guns, the PAC-88s, and just ripped through the ship. A few lucky hits, and the ship went down without a trace. Of course, there's been controversy ever since. There used to be, about 20 years ago, a self-raising flower, because the ship sank, and this is the HMS Sydney self-raising flower. So it was a little bit of it was a very serious thing, a little bit of a joke. It was sort of a bit like Bermuda Triangle or things like this. It was a mystery what happened to this ship. We didn't know about it, and of course we had various conspiracy theories. We have, occasionally Chinese submarines surfacing and stealing our Prime Minister. Like, our Prime Minister swam out to... You have to understand, there's a series of mysteries, and this is just fitted into the mystery group. There were groups of Australians who went out on holidays and just disappeared into the desert, never seen again. Irish backpackers. No, there was an Irish backpacker who disappeared in the 60s, and they found them in the 90s, the skeleton in the 90s. So there's all these mysteries. The Prime Minister of Australia went out swimming and just never came back. He was swimming at a remote beach, and so they have all these theories, conspiracy theories. So it's just standard conspiracy theory guff. I wouldn't actually put... I think HMS Sydney is in that conspiracy group. It's not really in the same group of these other willful, elaborate misinformation to the Australian people. I'm sure other countries have this as well. This is where they will, say, might celebrate. I know in France there was a big celebration, veneration of Napoleon, which probably is more equal. There's in England veneration of Nelson and stuff like that. And I suppose there's certain aspects of it, whether the actual stories of the individual or the individual traits sort of get set aside to talk about the superiority of the English persons over the French persons. I think that might be a bit of a bow here. And so it's really embarrassing if you actually don't believe in any particular country's superiority or anything like that. If you don't believe it, to hear people just trot this out, it's rather sad. Okay, out of the Midday Sun, the loss of the HMS Sydney 2. For almost 70 years, the loss of the Leander-class light cruiser, so that's what it was. It was our major battleship, but it was a light cruiser. HMS Sydney 2 in November 1941 has aroused controversy and speculation that has refused to die, no matter how heavy the weight of evidence and how strong the rational explanation that has been produced to explain the ship's demise. So after they found the Titanic, the next thing was to find the HMS Sydney, and they found it. Like a true zombie, a story is essentially simple, although tragic. Has taken a life of its own, ever more preposterous with each retelling. It is a story that has deep roots in the conspiracy theory, in a profound distrust of government and its agencies. In a sense, there must be a more sinister explanation. The very lack of evidence is evidence itself of a cover-up. Those closely associated with the Sydney, especially surviving family members, have been tormented over the years by suggestions that their loved ones were victims of a dastardly action on the part of the enemy, declared or otherwise, or even worse, victims of their own government's failure in both at the time and since. An understandable wish to know what happened has been manipulated, however unwittingly, by those who rejected the weight of evidence and rational explanations in favour of dark motives and lurid theorising. It's a shameful story of deception, deceit, sometimes self-imposed, but inevitably leading to the perpetuation of untruths and misguided and misleading assertions. I remember in the 70s there were UFO magazines, there were Yetis, and out in Australia there was wild cats escaped from zoos and various things. You know, there's the idea that there were actual mountain lions in Australia and all this type of stuff. So it's of that ilk. It's really not in the same level of central legend. The central facts are simple. On the November the 11th, 1941, HMS Sydney, under the command of Captain Joseph Burnett, Royal Australian Navy, left Fremantle, Western Australia, to escort the troop ship Zeelander to the Sunda Strait in the Netherlands East Indies. 8 days later, in the afternoon of the 19th of November, Sydney intercepted a ship that claimed to be a merchant vessel, Strait Malacca, or Malacca Strait, which was, in fact, the disguised German raider Cormorant. The Cormorant, which is spelt with a K, continued to send confusing signals in an attempt to avoid detection. Sydney drew closer, presumably anxious to settle the issue before falling light. Made that impossible. By doing so, it gave away its advantages of far power and distance. When the captain of the Cormorant realized that he could no longer maintain his disguise, he ordered his vessel's camouflage to be dropped, and the guns and torpedoes to be used at close, indeed almost point-blank range. a short, deadly exchange of fire ensued, both ships taking scores of hits. Sydney's control deck was demolished. The ship drifted out of control, with severe fires raging. It disappeared over the horizon, only an ever-dimming glow marking its presence. No survivors were recovered, although one body, now thought to be from the Sydney, was washed up in a Carly life raft on Christmas Island several months later. Cormand, so Christmas Island is, we've got a few, it certainly has a few islands up in the Indian Ocean, sort of deep into the Indian Ocean. There's Christmas Island. There's a couple of islands that Australia has, and they're owned by actually quite wealthy families. I think the Ross Smiths. They have a really unusual postcode, and so when people ask me where I'm purchasing something for my postcode, I give the postcode of these. These are islands in the middle of the Indian Ocean. Of course, I thought I would get some knowledge about these islands. So this is where this lifeboat went up. These essentially are air bases for the US. So you look at them and there's always these big B-52s or, you know, Galaxy troop, the US things landing on these islands, there are a rubber plantation. I think Christmas Island has a reasonably large population, a few thousand people. It's full of these tree-dwelling crabs which come aboard. So very interesting place. Some of these Indian Ocean islands. It disappeared over the horizon. Cormorant also was fatally damaged, and once his crew had safely abandoned ship, Captain Detmers gave orders for the ship to be scuttled. Subsequently, 345 crew survived and were picked up by passing ships or landed in Western Australian coast to be taken prisoners of war. And there is a lot of history of people being wrecked on the Western Australian coast. When Sydney failed to arrive on schedule at Fremantle, there was no immediate cause for concern, let alone alarm. It was thought that perhaps Burnett had diverted his ship, for whatever reason, to another port, and inquiries were made of Batavia, Batavia, which is the ancient capital. Absolute malaria nest, that one. And Singapore, to see if Singapore hadn't fallen. When is it? Singapore was about to be invaded, it's pretty well. And the Zealanders were the Aussie troops going up to be captured by the Japanese. Had arrived there, or was heading there. It was only then there was no indication that the Sydney was sailing in those directions, let alone had arrived at either port, that alarm bells began to ring. Air and sea searches were mounted, but nothing was found, not even the most minute traces. Sydney has disappeared, all 645 crew. Not until the German survivors appeared was it possible to establish that engagement had taken place, in that all likelihood the Sydney had been lost, although next of kin and crew were informed by telegram on the 27th of November. A formal statement was not issued by the Australian government until the 30th of November, 11 days after the encounter with the Cormorant. Rumours were already circulating. In the absence of all but the barest details, those rumours compounded. The passage of more than six decades has not diminished them, at least in some quarters, despite a number of careful analytical studies and two official inquiries. Like the proverbial zombies, the more wild explanations, the more preposterous the theories in the face of overwhelming evidence on the one hand and the total lack of credible evidence on the other, the life of these theories have survived. Cover-up is a recurring cry for those who argue in the face of rational explanation. And it seems that nothing will dim their conviction or bring them to acknowledge their error. Three central questions underpin the controversy. Why did the Sydney draw fatally close to Cormorant? and so do giving away its overwhelming superiority of firepower. Did Captain Dementis engage illegal tactics, which he subsequently tried to cover up, lest he be charged with war crimes? Why were the survivor rates so unbalanced? That is, 80% of Cormorant's crew and none of 0% of Sydney's. The simple answer to the first question might be that Captain Burnett made a mistake, one that proved fatal. In the overall scheme of things, he certainly misjudged the situation, with terrible consequences for his ship and crew. But that does not necessarily mean he was, as some have argued, incompetent. Even less does it support the argument advanced in some quarters that the Royal Australian Navy was engaged in a systematic cover-up rather than admit that one of its own had blundered. Burnett's actions can be explained, at least part, by a combination of factors, though we can never know precisely what calculations went through his mind. Unlike modern aircraft, ships do not have black boxes that, in extreme circumstances, can plot the actions leading to a crash. Further, a black box is an Australian invention, if you want to know. There you go. We haven't got flying, we haven't invented anything, but we've invented the black box. And we've invented a few navigation devices, sort of long-range navigation devices. First, there was, there's also Einstein invented a few avionic devices. Pretty interesting to know that he did that. There was the previous record of the Sydney that imposed on its captain and crew the burden of expectations that may have led Burnett to be less than ultra cautious. Because the Sydney One was the great warship. In World War One, Sydney One had distinguished itself by destroying the German cruiser, so a light cruiser destroys a bigger German cruiser, Emden, in the Indian Ocean. The first significant victory of the young RAN was celebrated in every wardroom. The famous signal, Emden breached and done for, became part of the RAN folklore. It was a proud precedent to live up to. Second, and more recent, was Sydney's two exploits in the Mediterranean, where under Captain John Collins, a different captain, RAN, the Sydney became the only light cruiser to sink a heavier ship. In this case, the Italian Bartolomeo Cannellini in July 1940 off the coast of Crete. Collins, his ship and crew were fated as heroes. So Collins is different from this one, Captain Burnett. And we have the Collins class submarine, so he's a famous person. That's why I think we named it after him. Now, interesting that Collins, Peter Collinhill, the double L. So Collins is a famous Irish name. So Collins was the revolutionary. There's a whole series of stories about revolutionaries. It's a very interesting story. Stories about it. Collins, his ship and crew were fated as heroes. When the ship returned to Australia, the crew marched through the streets of Sydney's in rapturous reception. If not quite David versus Goliath story, Sydney's exploits surely challenged Burnett to maintain the proud tradition already established. Some have argued that Burnett was insufficiently experienced to hold such an important command. He had served in the HMAS. So HMAS. Oh yeah, that's an Australian ship, Her Majesty's Australian ship, Australia, in the Grand Fleet of World War One, and in the interwar years had extensive experience with both Royal Navy and Royal Australian Navy, both at sea and postings ashore. True, Sydney was the first sea command, but there was nothing in his extensive record to suggest other than he was well equipped to assume this new position. Rather than competence, the explanation of Burnett's actions on the fateful day lie elsewhere. First, there was a general policy in force that whenever possible, enemy merchant ships were to be captured, a policy that had been reiterated by the Admiralty as recently as the 4th of November, that is, 2 weeks before the encounter with the Cormorant. Burnett had received instructions from the Assistant Chief of Naval Staff that if necessary, ships were to be boarded in order to clarify their status and were they found to be enemy vessels, their log and code books were to be seized before they could be destroyed and the ship was scuttled. In other words, there was no question whether any doubt at all existed of standing off at a distance and destroying the suspect ship with the use of superior firepower. Second, Burnett was surely mindful of the criticism directed at his fellow Jervis Bay classmate and rival, Captain Harold Farnham, RAM, who early in 1941 was the commander of the HMS Canberra, engaged German ship Coburg and Getty Berwick by maintaining a distance of 19,000 yards, or 70 kilometres, and expended what was subsequently deemed an excessive amount of ammunition that was in general short supply. So, now, let me tell you about Jervis Bay. So, the Australian Capital Territory was deemed to have a port. So our capital city, the people, was to be between Melbourne and Sydney, or even Brisbane. They're all port cities, so they said, look, it has to have a port. Capital city has to have a port. So what they did is they settled on Canberra, and they made the port of Canberra in a separate territory, 200 kilometres away from Canberra. So you have to travel out of Canberra, you have to travel 200 kilometres through New South Wales to reach the Australian Capital Territory of Jervis Bay. And Jervis Bay is the Australian Naval School, and there's the Australian-based aircraft carrier. We've got a aircraft carrier, which is a piece of concrete in the ground at the moment. Okay, so... when this critical report was written by the Navy Office, Burnett was on its staff and would have been acutely aware of the black mark on the captain's record for such a report constituted undue caution on the one hand and extravagant and unnecessary use of ammunition on the other. The combination was a combination to be avoided. So you just don't, especially if you see a merchant vessel. Burnett's critics are at odds with each other. Some argue that he lacked initiative and stuck too closely to established practice. Others say he ignored those practices and recklessly endangered his ships. In either view, so the case against Burnett goes, he was incompetent, or at the very least, complacent. To compound his failure, he was described by a former crew member of the Sydney as a British captain whose arrogance had resulted in his ship's loss. This was but another twist on the theme of the Australians have always suffered at the hands of incompetent British commanders. In John Laffan's British Butchers and Bunglers, being one of the more notorious examples of the genre, along with Peter Bowie's reconstruction of the disastrous charge at the Linnet, where in the film Literally the officers ordered a charge with a British accent to reinforce the impression Australian lives were recklessly squandered by British incompetence. So, just to give you an idea, I think the Australians landed a fairly big force, and it's at most they ventured a kilometre. The Neck is about 2 kilometres inland, and all the fighting was of no strategic importance whatsoever. So, very interesting. So, the Neck is something I now know about, having read the earlier chapters. And sort of know about the size. I think Lone Pine is only 200 metres from the beach. So if we had a beach house at Lone Pine, we'd think we'd be, in general, you sight your houses a bit back from the beach. Have a nice little walk to the beach. In publishing completely inaccurate comments In publishing the completely inaccurate comments of an old man, the Sydney Daily Telegraph in March 2008 pandered to the prejudices and ignorance of its readers. Nor did it ever correct the statement. Burnett's two sons, who themselves are exemplary careers in their own, maintained their dignified silence, however hurtful. No doubt this was just another ill-informed attack on their father. Born in New South Wales and a proud graduate of the Royal Australian Navy College, Jervis Bay, facts never got in the way of a baseless accusation. So they accused him of being British, even though he was born in New South Wales. It must be said, however, that the British argument has not been picked up by most protagonists. How could it be, unless indirectly, rather than the point of difference? The very closeness between RN and the RAN the Royal Navy and the Royal Australian Navy, has fueled the accusation that the naval community at the time and since has closed ranks to protect its own, that the reputation and the standing of the service is more important than the performance of a single individual. The argument ascribes to the RAN powers of control and single-mindedness that would surely flabbergast anyone with even a fleeting acquaintance with its history, i.e. leaked like anything. Like its sister services, and indeed like all services in every country, it has had its share of strong-willed individuals, the men and women of an ambition, some more capable than others, all with varying degrees of dedication, but the notion that it would pursue and maintain a policy of cover-up for nearly 70 years is laughable. To put bluntly, the Navy has far more important things with which to occupy its overstretched resources. And really, if you actually look at the spend per sea area covered, like Australia's got a huge sea area and we've got a microscopic spend, I don't know how we do it. For Captain Burnett, the dilemma was surely acute. How to identify another ship without endangering his own? And once identified, how to close and seize the log and code books? What if Allied prisoners on board were prisoners of war were on board? There's no easy answer to the question of identification. So what he basically needed is a small launch ship that he could send up. The other ship responded to signals of the Sydney with incomplete or confusing answers, but Burnett could not be sure that the captain was in possession of the latest codes, which had been circulated only very recently. Radio silence was imperative, so this is flashing, so there would be no question of checking with the authorities. In the late Sunday, it was certain that the Sydney signals would be properly received by the other ship. Might it slip away as light began to fail? The unknown consequences of security in the Indian Ocean if it did turn out to have been a disguised raider. Burnett chose to close, and in doing so, surrendered to the advantages of long-range firepower. Despite the surprise was always in the hands of the Cromlech, when Demetrius gave the orders to engage, it was inevitable that at the very least both ships would sustain heavy damage. Burnett's decision turned out to be fatal consequences, but not it was as a result of incompetence, rather a calculated risk that failed. The second question that persisted is whether Captain Demetrius used illegal tactics. This argument draws its forces from the belief that the loss of the Sydney, and especially the loss of its entire crew, at the hands of a ship inferior in speed and firepower, could only be explained by the enemy's resort to underhand, if not downright illegal, methods. Pacific charged that Demetrius flew a false flag to draw the Sydney even closer, and only at the point when his disguise was about to be exposed did he order the German battle flag to be hoisted, although some critics have claimed the Comet never at any point flew the battle ensign. Secondly, Demetrius is accused of flying a white flag of surrender, thereby luring the Sydney to a point where Burnett was about to order a boarding party to approach the Cormorant. Or what is the evidence of this? Clearly, there is no eyewitness accounts from the Sydney, which leaves only the German survivors. Their evidence, however, has been routinely dismissed as unreliable and self-serving. For some critics, they were, after all, Nazis, and therefore not to be trusted. Other critics, however, have pointed to a statement that Demetrius Detmers, indicating his subsequent concern that he might be court-martialed, as evidence that he knew he was guilty of war crimes. In this case, it would, however, seem much more likely that he was expressing the view, which close to 70 years of rumour have not quelled, that such a catastrophic loss and lopsided loss could only be accepted by Australian public if couched in terms of illegal behaviour on the part of the Sydney's opponent. Far from being any sort of admission of wrongdoing, Demetrius' statement reflected deep belief in some of sections of Australian community who could not, and still cannot, accept. On the day in question, Sydney was outclassed by the Cormorant. Third question. Why was there no survivors of the Sydney compared to the Cormorant's 80% survival rate? Has given rise to the most sensational accusations. Both ships sustained heavy damage, with Cormorant's guns destroying Sydney's bridge and gunnery's director tower, and at least one of its torpedoes hitting the Sydney near the bow, causing major damage and ultimately proved fatal. Cormorant was badly damaged, and after Dementia's ordering firing to cease, it continued to to a range of 11 kilometres as Sydney, fiercely ablaze, limped away. He instructed his own crew to abandon ship, and then he detonated charges to scuttle the Cormorant. Later that night, the crew of the Cormorant, now adrift in lifeboats, watched the glow of the increasingly distant Sydney grow fainter and disappeared. Disproportionate loss has given rise to the most extreme charges, most notably those propounded by Michael Montgomery, son of the Royal Navy navigator on board the Sydney. Montgomery has argued the Cormorant was assisted in the exchange with the Sydney by a Japanese submarine, and that the Sydney's crew abandoned ship and they were machine-gunned in the water to cover up the evidence of Japanese involvement and German illegality. Had there been a shred of evidence beyond wild surmise, these would be extremely serious charges, but there's no such evidence. The movements of all Japanese submarines were carefully recorded by Japanese naval authorities, and there is nothing to show that Japanese submarine was anywhere near the Sydney Cormorant encounter. Critics counter by arguing that either Japanese have concealed the true movements of their own submarines, or that another submarine, not the published list, that undertook the criminal acts. In either case, it would appear to be a cunning Oriental interpretation still has some currency. Attempts to give this line of argument some force refer to the broader strategic situation. In November 1941, United States was still neutral, although top-secret discussions had been underway for months between the US and the United Kingdom. British Prime Minister Winston Churchill was desperate to get the US into the war against Germany and, so the argument goes, needed a major incident involving US to achieve this end. No longer the bungling and incompetent British, but a scheming, manipulative imperial power. A Japanese attack on an Australian warship, however, much to be deplored, was not sufficient gravity to bring the US entry into the war, but was required, what was required was a direct attack on American assets. So the involvement of the Japanese submarine in the Sydney Cormorant encounter had to be hushed up, while Churchill waited for a more spectacular act of Japanese aggression to swing the American position into entering the war. That's absolutely bonkersly stupid. Several weeks later, the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor provided the impetus to effect the change in American policy. There is, it is true, a certain logic in the argument if placed in the realm of counterfactual or iffy. If that had not happened, this would be the explanation. But it fails, I like the word counterfactual, it fails when its proponents are asked to provide evidence. There is none. At one stage, those who pushed this line would point to a group of documents at the National Archives London relating to correspondence between Churchill and the US President Franklin Delano Roosevelt in November 1941 that were then still closed to public examination. When those closed files were released, what did it reveal? The senior officer in the Admiralty had been paid as a consultant to the Imperial Japanese Navy and to the armaments manufacturer Mitsubishi in the late 1930s. After being warned of the inappropriate nature of his dealings, he had severed his ties with the Japanese, but he remained under suspicion, not the least because of his highly sensitive position as director of Air Materiel. In order to avert any suspicion in the American minds of security leaks, he was quietly moved out of the Admiralty and spent the rest of the war in an obscure Scottish posting. There was a cover-up, but there was nothing to do with the Sydney. Okay, so there was a cover. They did find a cover-up, but not to do with the Sydney. It's pretty interesting, as found out. So that's a bit complicated. There was a British person who may have been leaking American secrets to Japan. Proponents of the arguments are not the slightest bit abashed by this, or the general lack of evidence to support their claims. Of course there is no evidence, they reply. It has been removed as part of a wider cover-up.
far from being an argument based on evidence, it is merely an assertion, one that is assumed far too much time with an effort in the attempts at rebuttal. It's interesting. So they're saying, look, you opened it up and we have found a cover-up. That's good. We have found a cover-up, but it's a very weird, low-level cover-up. Why was the search not launched immediately? Here again, critics argue the delay was designed to conceal the unpleasant truths of the Australian public. What are the facts 2 days after the comet was scuttled? On the 26th, if it's true, were located by the converted liner carrier Aquinania. It's interesting that the I think that's one where a lot of immigrants came to Australia on that one. It's a liner. It used to be a liner, but it's now a troop carrier. But fearing the presence of enemy ships in the vicinity, and in accordance with established procedures, it did not break radio silence to inform the authorities until it had reached the comparative safety of Victorian waters. And the following day, 24th of November, that is 5 days after the fatal encounter, the British tanker merchant vessel Troscus picked up another group of cormorant survivors and informed the Navy by means of coded signal. So the basic answer to the question of the failure to mount immediate search is quite simple. No one knew for certain that anything untoward had happened. It was only in retrospect on the 19th of November it took special significance. 19th of November. Some have claimed that during the course of the encounter, Sydney sent a signal. Had Sydney tried to alert the authorities that it was under attack, the signal would have been instantly jammed by the Cormorant, whose communication crew had been warned and readied for this eventuality. It would appear also that Sydney's ability to send a signal was destroyed in the early stages of the fire. Exhaustive searches for the relevant archives have failed to produce any evidence of such a signal, which, of course, in the minds of conspiracy theory, is merely a proof of a cover-up. And the claims of those who stated they were present when the signal was received would have been convincingly shown to be uninformed at best. In the years following the end of World War II, the public interest in the loss of the Sydney declined in terms of the wider community, but grew in intensity amongst a number of groups determined to find out what had happened. Surviving family members were understandably concerned to know how their loved ones had died, who, if anyone, was to be blamed for the disaster. Others, not necessarily connected with the families, sought to have the loss of the Sydney investigated to establish the truth, which, of course, coincided with their particular version. Not all of them could be true. To answer the persistent critics asserting there was, or at least had been, a cover-up, the Australian government decided in 1997 to request the Joint Standing Committee on Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade investigate the loss of Sydney to make such recommendations as it saw fit. This was to be an entirely open inquiry with a call for submissions from any individuals or groups wished to present. Material followed by public hearings in which the various submissions could be subjected to questioning. The response from the public was astonishing. More than 400 submissions were received, many multiple submissions from individuals or groups. Public hearings were held in Canberra, Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane and Perth, the latter being especially well attended, with a large room in the Perth Hotel having standing room only. Those appearing before the committee were given every opportunity to air their views and produce whatever evidence they had to support their views, even when testimony veered off into the irrelevant or unsupported. This was a necessary condition if the inquiry was to be judged fair, open and willing to listen. That it was, and even if the proponents of some of the more extreme views rejected its findings. In terms of settling historical questions, the committee failed. None of the parties or individuals who made submissions seemed ready to accept that their evidence was, in many cases, nothing more than second-hand hearsay. Indeed, as the final report of the committee predicted, quote, it is unavoidable that those who have chosen to see cover-up in the conspiracy will seek to condemn the inquiry as part of the same cover-up, while rejecting the wilder accusations and speculations that surround this matter. Quote, the committee stressed that it, quote, in no way doubts the honesty of any individuals who made submissions,
quote, end quote. However, he went on to emphasize that a, quote, firmly held belief that something is true does not make it necessarily so, end quote. This was a generous to the excessive degree. To hold beliefs in the face of overwhelming evidence is at least mischievous, if not downright dishonest. But to resolve the wide differences between various camps in the Sydney controversy was beyond the committee's remit. It had been charged with investigating the circumstances surrounding the loss of the Sydney, and in particular to ascertain whether there was any archival or other resources that had not at this point been studied. This it did, and if the report was less than conclusive than many had hoped for, that was a more reflection on the basis assertions of many of the witnesses than it was on the patience and competence of the committee. The committee made a number of recommendations, the most important which were that attempts should be made to locate the grave of the men washed ashore on Christmas Island in 1942, and that the search be made for the wreck of the Sydney and the Cormorant. The committee sought, however, apart from confirming the accounts of the German survivors and as to the locations of the battle, to discover the wrecks would be not provide much else in the way of explanatory details. It did acknowledge, however, that the commemorative process which would follow from such a discovery would play an important part in resolving the frustration experienced by the families over many years. Before a search could be mounted with a reasonable degree of success, the committee recommended that a seminar be held in Fremantle to canvass views on the probable locations of the battle, which would be given a guide to an area of research, an investigation into the probable location of the Christmas Island body, which would possibly enable the identification to be made and a positive link with the city established, and a discussion on the methods which might be used to locate the wrecks. The committee hoped that a broad consensus might emerge that would give clear guidance to the Navy if the search deemed to have the potential to succeed. It did not turn out that way. Just as the committee had commented in its reports, those sincerely held beliefs were unwilling to accept the rigorous examination of the evidence underpinning those beliefs. This was especially so in the matter of the location of the battle. The overwhelming weight of opinion of writers on the subject has always argued in favour of a northern location, basically in line with the Cormorant survivors had said. Glenys MacDonald, who chaired the oral history panel, disagreed, insisting that there was sufficient evidence to at least warrant investigation of a more southerly site. The evidence she adduced from the oral recollections of a number of elderly residents of Port Gregory, a tiny settlement in the north, a little north of Geraldton. As schoolchildren, they had been returning from a school function on the night of November the 1914, when they saw bright flashes and heard loud noises out to sea. Could this have been the Sydney Cormorant engagement? Leaving aside the fact that the accountants could not be certain that their experience was on the same night as the battle, and accepting the children saw and heard something, it seemed an extraordinarily long bow to draw to claim that they had seen and heard it was the battle. MacDonald was adamant, subsequently complaining about the seminar's commenter's view in a letter to the local press, and then, when the transcript of proceedings directly contradicted her interpretation of the commentator's remarks, rewriting the episode to support her stance. No matter, the essential point is, and was stated in the seminar, I have to say that I am no closer in my own mind after listening to her very detailed presentations to deciding what the answers to the questions where, when, and what are. This is not to dismiss her theories, but simply to say that the necessary link between the experiences of these individuals and the loss of the Sydney has not been established. In her later book, subtitled A Quest for the Truth, MacDonald simply replied, I disagree. MacDonald also propounded the theory that some of the bodies of the Sydney had been sighted by the SS Cape Otway, a lighthouse tender, by SS Cape Otway. a Lattes tender. I don't know why you call it a ship. Which had been ordered from the area to prevent this story circulating, and the ship's logbooks altered to delete the mention. So there's it will be a lighthouse ship. Because there's heaps of reefs around there. Her evidence for the sighting of the bodies was again the oral recollection of children who had been aboard the Cape Otway while an examination of the logbook convinced her that it had been tampered with. In her books, she offered two possible scenarios for the disposal of the bodies, which could have been badly decomposed by the time of their recovery. The crew of the Cape Otway either were temporarily buried or machine gunned to destroy them to conceal any of any details that might cause distress to the families. Shee whiz. So these are you see these are little ships with lighthouses glowing on them. Why there were children on that boat, I don't understand. Another twist on the body story was given by John Samuels in his book in 2005, subtitled The Sydney Scandal Exposed. Samuels was described on the rear cover as a journalist, an intelligence analyst, and a skilled historian, and the book was endorsed by Professor Bruce Hurstford at the University of Southern Queensland as a remarkable for its candour, common sense, horse sense, and Samuels' thought-provoking scrutiny of tough questions. Sorry. The front cover made the central argument inescapable, a photograph of the Sydney against the Imperial Japanese war flag. To be fair, the authors do not have much control of the design of books. While they are responsible for what appears between the covers, they are all too often at the mercy of marketing wizards when it comes to the packaging of their work. Nevertheless, Samuel's approach fully reflected the sensational marketing of his conclusions. Samuel's claimed that the Japanese submarine had participated in the Sydney Cormorant battle, and that its crew had machine-gunned Sydney survivors. The bodies subsequently picked up at sea by the Cape Otway and buried in scrub-covered sand dunes. The whole business was concealed, not by the Australian government, but from the Australian government. There is no conspiracy between the cabinet and Iran, just a few holier-than-thou spineless senior officers pondering to the grand heirs of mother countries and looking to please the Admiralty and the Prime Ministers. The only real PM, as far as they were concerned, was Winston Churchill. Oh dear, this is getting weirder and weirder. So Japanese submarines and this little boat, this little... So the Cape Otway, if you imagine it, if you imagine a naval boat with heaps of guns, this is a big boat with a big lighthouse on top of it. And so it goes on, from reminding the reader that all eyewitnesses' accounts came from the enemies of Australia, servants of the Third Reich, and insisting the senior officers betrayed their own country and failed treacherously in their duty. It was a strong stuff. It was also largely untrue. Charges that RAN was consistently sought to conceal evidence that might challenge the official account of what happened to the Sydney have not been based on any substantive evidence being produced. However, there is one area that has helped nourish the belief that the Navy has been partly to cover up. For many years, the Navy rejected the widely held view that the man washed ashore in Christmas Island in February 1942 had come from the Sydney, and it was said persisted in its position in the face of mounting evidence and common sense. Following the 2001 seminar, at which it had been reported that an attempt to locate the buried site on Christmas Island had failed, a further attempt was made, this time successfully, which raised hope the body might be identified. Several families had insisted the man was their relatives, and that the examination of the body might provide further clues to the mystery surrounding the Sydney. So you can imagine other war-torn countries, you know, like Germany gets completely bombed and stuff like that, and London gets bombed, we lose a ship, and we've got all these inquiries going on. And Sydney's, they've got one body coming out. Unfortunately, it proved impossible to identify the sailor, now accepted by the Navy to come for the Sydney, and the body was eventually reburied the war cemetery in Geraldton. However, examination of the body revealed a wound to the head, which gave rise to considerable speculation. Could this wound be unassailable evidence of a Japanese involvement or support of the argument that the crew of the Comet had machine-gunned Sydney's survivors? No. Metallurgical examination showed the wound was caused by a piece of shrapnel, not a bullet, and that the metal was of the German manufacture. Another plank in the conspiracy cover-up argument was destroyed. So this person, he could have been machine gun, but his fatal wound was from a piece of German naval artillery. Now, that's pretty amazing. That's why we have all these big labs in Australia going through war stuff. The controversy, or rather controversies, might have continued to fester had it not been for the discovery of the wreck of the Titanic on the 1st of September 1985. The location of this famous wreck in deep waters in the North Atlantic reigns the hope that the wrecks of the Sydney and Cormorant might similarly be located. Although the Joint Standing Committee had cautioned that the discovery of the wrecks was unlikely to add much by the means of explaining what happened, there was a resurgence in interest that ultimately led to a flurry of stories about the possible location of the wrecks. An article in the now-defunct Bulletin claimed... So the Bulletin is just such a rag paper when you come across it. It was such a respected paper. Claimed to have discovered the wreck of Sydney and nearby Japanese aircraft carrier, hitherto unknown to naval historians. Presumably unacknowledged by the Japanese themselves. In 2007, Sydney Morning Herald, a broadsheet once respected for the depth of reporting, claimed in huge frontline headlines, "We found the HMS Sydney," when a local fisherman showed a supposed wreck of nothing more than an abandoned poor trawler when that was well known in the area. The paper declined to make any comment for several days, perhaps agonising over how to explain that its correspondents had been unable to distinguish between the warships and a fishing boat. Starting up again after a brief break, we'll sound as though you in podcast land won't hear the break, but I was running out of energy and I had tasks to do inside, and I'll see if I can get this done before I take my daughter off to the airport. Okay, and I also in the meantime got to get online and actually look up this flower, and it is Sydney flower with a big ship on it, which it looks like the HMS Sydney, and it's hard to say, it's not a battleship, but with the word self-raising flower, it obviously struck a chord with it, and we'll get on to that. But at this point in time, the intrepid person has reported finding the wreck as a washed-up prawn trawler. Obviously, a prawn trawler will look different from a battleship. And typically, it's been predicted by the Sydney Morning Herald and then quietly disappeared as a retraction many, many months later in a little paragraph. You can often find these retractions in a time. They're not a big... They somehow arranged the retractions. Retractions are only in a 3 centimetre wide columns tucked underneath advertisements. But let's listen to this. The discovery of the wrecks of the Cormorant and shortly afterwards the Sydney in March 2008 was a triumph for those who had laboured long and hard to bring about this achievement in the face of a lack of enthusiasm on the part of the government and, it must be said, in circumstances where there was not any great degree of sustained public interest outside a fairly small Sydney circle of Sydney relatives and those determined to solve the multiple mysteries they'd made up. I've added that one. Now, it seemed that the answers could be found, not at least for the visual inspection of the wrecks, so the vital gaps in the detail and the story of the encounter might be filled in, and with some comfort of knowing what had really happened to those could be afforded to the grieving families. Several details quickly emerged. The Cormorant wreck was found almost exactly where the German survivors said it had been sunk. Statements that had been widely dismissed as deliberately misleading accounts designed to conceal darker truths. Secondly, the photographs show the Sydney's bow had been severed, causing the ship to sink almost instantaneously, which is a very likely explanation for the loss of life on the Sydney compared with the relatively orderly abandonment of the Cormorant by its crew. Following the discovery of the two wrecks, the Chief of Defence Force, Air Chief Marshal Angus... I know him. He was actually turned the Chief of the Combined Defence Forces eventually. He's Defence of the Chief. He was... I remember him as Defence of the Chief of the Defence Force. ACFC announced the establishment of a commission of inquiry into the loss of HMS Sydney 2. So this is a military version rather than a civilian version, to be headed by the Honourable Terence Cole, AO, RFD, QC. So AO means Order of Australia. In his primary statement, President Cole puts the loss of lives on the board of Sydney in a broader context of the Australian military history. More were lost in Sydney than in the entire Korean or Vietnam wars. I think Vietnam was 550 people, and about, I think, around 50 in direct combat, where the actual Vietnamese actually fired on Australians. The rest were in road accidents or industrial accidents of such a large-scale operation in a war zone. I think on mines, but it's generally, I think, 23 and 16 in direct battles in Vietnam, whereas Korea, again, less than 600 in Korea. Okay, that's from my memory. Or on the Kokoda Trail. Amazingly, although the Kokoda Trail was a hard fight, there was actually very few people killed on either side on the actual trail itself. He added, presumably, in reference to locating the wrecks, turning the page, quote, "No country which is respectful of its military personnel or military traditions or of its national history can allow such a loss to remain unexplained when the circumstances have occurred which may allow, for the first time, an explanation of the circumstances of their deaths." So now he's saying, why we're having the commission now, we've found the wrecks, let's have a good look at it. You can imagine, now I have more information, I can start to wade through some of the theories. So obviously if it's wrecked in the north, the people in the south, that must be invention, mustn't it? Those school children who thought, oh, I heard a bang and a bit of light. You can imagine school children. And around Australia, you do hear these unexplained explosions, or it could be earthquakes and stuff like that, like rumblings in the distance. Often when you're out bushwalking, there'll be just nothing, and then you'll hear what could be a mining explosion or something, but often at 2 o'clock in the morning, something like that. And then myself bushwalking, I've seen these strange lights. You see these, it's just part of the deal, I think. Against the broad statement by the President, Council Assisting Inquiry Commander Jack Rush, RFD, QC, ANR, Royal Australian Navy, what R stands for, made it clear from the outset that although no one due to appear before the Commission had requested leave to be represented by a counsel, there would be no less rigorous integration of the evidence. The Commission, he stressed, was inquisitorial by nature. So it's rather than just get everything out on the record, this one was actually going to work through it. It certainly was, whereas the parliamentary inquiry had been remarkably tolerant when listening to those who appeared before it. The Cole Commission was more demanding when it came to the burden of proof. Time and again, Commander Rush challenged witnesses on their shaky grasp of elementary logic or pressed them to answer the question when they sought to prevaricate or wander off into irrelevance. The transcripts of the hearings laid bare, for the most part, the absurd accusations of the cover-up propagandists. So, what's it, the Rothschild incident, sort of in the US have that sort of thing. The steady, almost relentless questioning of the conspiracy advocates by the senior counsel, timely interventions by the president, progressively stripped away any pretense that cover-up theories might have had. A brief outline, so this is your zombie full attack. A brief outline of several of the sessions shows the poverty of their arguments. Michael Montgomery, so he's the person who said the Japanese, aircraft carrier and all that stuff, was one of the leading conspiracy cover-up advocates, wrote to the Commission of Inquiry to say that while his original overestimate of where the action had taken place was now proved inaccurately, i.e. totally wrong, would be a better word, they say in brackets, quote, "In almost all other important aspects, the arguments of my book have been borne out by the very considerable body of evidence which has emerged since the publication of its final edition in 1986. So 2 years after his publication, they found the wreck. The claim was breathtaking and was exposed by the persistent questioning by Commander Rush for the concoction of hearsay, invention, and lack of logic that it was. Under close questioning, Glenys MacDonald, she wrote the book about the machine gunning of, I don't know, the Otway, absolutely accepted that it was impossible for the children of Earth, she was the one who worked on the Port Gregory theory, accepted that it was absolutely impossible for the children of Port Gregory in November 1914 to have seen or heard the Sydney Cormorant battle since the discovery of the wrecks. Indisputably placed the site of the battle some 400 kilometres away. Similarly, her assertion that the Cape Otway had located the bodies within Sydney had been ordered to leave the area to maintain secrecy and that its log was tampered with was shown to be without foundation. In explaining her conclusions, which President Cole pointed out had to be distinguished from fact, even though they were often presented as fact, Mrs. MacDonald stated that, quote, "I always believed that oral history was problematic, but if you heard the same story from two independent sources, then it was worthy of consideration and scrutiny." Worthy of consideration, yes, but it was all too often lacking in the approach of so many critics of what might be called standard explanation of the Sydney's demise was sustained rigorous and critical scrutiny. So if two people came and said the same hearsay, well, that's enough for her. Which is the fundamental thing of these people. They have a much lower standard of proof and a much more aggressive interaction. Sort of, if you can imagine these parameters of people, low standard of proof, a high aggressiveness, might be described, where they put other people down, don't let people speak, leave arguments unconcocted. I forgot this phase space of these people, and in my head, I sort of have a quantum mechanical cloud of them out there, and I'm scratching my head how to deal with them. But these people have got a commission, and they're listing them bit by bit. John Samuels, author of Somewhere Below, fared more badly under persistent questioning from from Commander Rush. He admitted that he, quote, "would be the first one to say that I can't prove that a Japanese submarine sank or had anything to do with HMS Sydney," and later he said that he had nothing solid to support his theory. Similarly, when pressed by both Commander Rush and the President, Samuels reluctantly, it seems, conceded that, in the words of the President, there was not a sherrick of evidence to support, quote, "the bodies buried along the coast scenario." Because, I mean, now it's 400 kilometres away. Although the qualified answer to a series of questions by saying, quote, "I don't have any evidence as such, no." Again, there was a case of being too willing to accept hearsay and third-hand accounts at face value without applying the necessary rigour and critical analysis. The President got right to the point. Okay, this is actually quite good. I'm just reading a little bit ahead, and I think if you've laboured through listening to this podcast, this is probably worthwhile listening to. President Cole, "What is the difference between making something up and an assumption for which you have no basis for the assumption? I don't know, sir." In other words, it would be fair for us to conclude that your book, something you put in the book, as a matter of fact, for which you had not a scintilla of evidence support. Yes, so he made it up. But I like it, this. What's the difference between making something up and making an assumption for which you have no evidence? Nothing. Any credibility, of course, unfortunately, that's John Samuels, President Cole, and Commander Rush. They're operating at a higher level, intellectual level, than John Samuels, unfortunately, so he's a bit at loss. And this is your entire problem here, in that these people sort of build up defence mechanisms to protect themselves from their own stupidity. Any credibility of the author, and unfortunately Australian stupidity is entrenched and enshrined in Australia, any credibility that the author of these arguments may have utterly collapsed. Later in the proceedings, President commented that, quote, "neither Montgomery or Samuels has presently advised, would regard as remotely reliable source." The suggestion that the bodies of the Sydney had been buried in the sand dunes of the Western Australian coast and the burial party sworn to secrecy was investigated at length by the Commission. David Arguin, who described himself as a digger, someone with a shovel,
nor has press provided evidence to support the claim that a Japanese submarine was involved in the sinking of the Sydney. The crew of the submarine murdered the survivors of the Sydney and were then murdered by the crew of the Cormorant. Ogwen told the commission that he had already undertaken 8 digging expeditions in Shark Bay area. Quote, "I'm trying to dig up a couple of 100 bodies with the bullet holes in the head," but admitted on every matter the substance he had no evidence to support his assertion, and accepted the president's description of his arguments as speculation, as wild guess, superstition. He seemed unwilling to accept or unable to understand that opinion, however sincerely held, had no value in settling controversy, is based on some form of evidence that could be examined and tested. And this, unfortunately, is suburban Australia. The average people, once they're prejudiced and they believe something, they think that if there's no evidence, I really believe it. It must be true. And then, of course, if you challenge them, you're challenging their authority. You don't respect them. It's a really horrible thing to be in Australia.
This is the third section of reading chapter 6 about HMS Sydney. And I've just come back from, sound continuous, but in this magic time I've travelled out to the airport and seen my daughter off. And we've up to the point where we've got a civilian, let's have it all out, gathering in all the evidence, and then the more fantastical books, and then there's a military commission which has now been launched with the aid of having discovered the wrecks, so they've got some hard evidence to start to actually wheedle their way through some of this point, and they're trying to make a point to the civilian people, or to people in general. The quote is, "What's the difference between making something up and making an assumption when you have no basis for the assumption?" Now, fortunately, there's two things that happened in this trip. I was able to ask one person who is, I feel, prone to doing that type of stuff. And they said this rather revealing thing. The difference between making something up and making an assumption for which you have no evidence is that that assumption can help you think and form a picture, whereas you're making something up, that's sort of like it's like you've been caught and it's a short-term fix. An assumption for which you have no evidence, you have a bigger vignette to look into. So the latter, assumption with no evidence, is something where you have great consideration, you can consider it, whereas making something up is something that you can get caught out on, whereas the assumption with no evidence is something that you can hang on to for a much longer time. That was very interesting. The other aspect is my other daughter was driving us up to the airport and back, and so I was able to hoe into a book on the origin of the sun and the sun myths behind Japan. So it is very interesting that red dot in a white flag represents the sun. I also believe that the actual sun came down and actually created the line of emperors. This is a long time to go out. It's very interesting about how, in terms of mythology, like we're concerned about the Australians making up myths, this mythology of the sun coming down is just so enormous in the creation of a whole range of things. So I don't know if I made that clear. I'm sort of out here suffering with Australian myths, but this entire myth industry is huge. Huge to the point that you have the Japanese war flag, a sun with sun rays coming out of it, and the sun emperor, the sun coming down and forming the emperor, is just well worth looking at. But let's get back into the reading. The report of the Commission of Inquiry was handed to the Chief of Defence Force in July 2009 and was made available to the Department of Defence website several hours after public release on the 12th of August 2009. Okay, although the Commissioner Cole found that Captain Burnett had made almost inexplicable series of errors that doomed the Sydney, he specifically declined to make any finding of negligence. This was a reasonable conclusion, for we can never know precisely what went through Burnett's mind as the drama played out in a terrible conclusion. And this is the entire thing, is that negligence, you have to actually see that someone's just not incompetent or misled. You have to actually see negligence as a legal thing for negligence. A whole volume of the report, a whole volume of the report was devoted to the close examination of the various conspiracies, cover-up and fraud theories that bedeviled the Sydney controversy, and which, according to internationally renowned shipwreck hunter David Mearns, delayed any action to find the wreck for more than 20 years. So this is interesting that a shipwreck expert says, well, we could have found it really easily, but the interplay of these people. And this is, I find that also interesting that these myth people, when you actually step back and take and join all the dots, they are actually stopping the more rational things coming forward. So that's a very interesting thing. The transcripts constitute a devastating expose of the ill-founded theories of the conspiracy cover-up advocates, and the clear demolition both their logic and their evidence. The logic's in quotes. The hearing convincingly demonstrates that beliefs, no matter how sincerely held, are no substitute for hard evidence. And this is an interesting, I find that this process here is the actual point here, is this talking to this person about assumptions. They've said, well, an assumption with no evidence, if I hold it dearly and it really helps me, that's different from just making something up to deceive someone. Not that that quite makes sense for me. In his final report, Commissioner Cole was brutally direct. Each of the frauds, theories, speculations was investigated. None has any substance whatsoever. End quote. For that alone, the Commission has more than justified its existence and will have achieved its aim at bringing some comfort, which is really what you're doing. That a lot of these people, and like a lot of the tittle-tattle you hear up here in domestic Glenbrook, at the end of the day doesn't really help the people that ostensibly the tittle tat is to help resolution of the families of the Sydney crew by offering rational explanations for what happened in place of the wilder arguments that have emerged over the years and that can have done nothing to bring peace to the mind of bereaved, which is so true. This is like a textbook. Thinking of Sydney is a long-term textbook thing of just Australians behaving badly. So no one in particular is behaving badly, but en masse, the dull march of rational thought is too hard for us. Will the conspiracies, the cover-up accusations finally die away? Probably not. Zombie myths are almost impossible to destroy as long as there are gullible people willing to listen and to fasten a single piece of the story that has not been explained to their satisfaction because it cannot be explained at a distance from the events. And look, dare I say, and those people also dismiss the value of the, you know, oh, he's a historian. I can give you just mind-blowing examples of people just not listening and saying, hey, I can give you so many examples of it. And it's really bad, of course, when people like this are in charge of minors and they're making decisions on behalf of them, say for cancer treatments or serious life-threatening diseases. They just cannot think rationally. And so that's a case where I've seen it really play out in a devastating thing, something where you're just jaw-dropping. Inevitably, it seems zombie myths mutate and gain new life. This is the entire thing, is that I think this idea of mutating. Those who want to believe in extraordinary explanations can take heart from the recent story on the ABC radio where a Western Australian recounted how some 50 years before, an acquaintance told him that he discovered a cave near Broome that contained ancient Greek writing and reading somewhere that Alexander the Great had ordered many of the ships to be built following the invasion of India in a 3rd century BC, speculated that Alexander was buried somewhere in the vicinity of Broome. Digging expeditions will surely follow, as the midday sun
In the midday sun, it is good an explanation as any for this propensity to embrace the bizarre. There is a propensity to embrace the bizarre. But I think the midday sun is not the is not a literal midday sun. That's the heat. It's the heat of mediocrity, mental mediocrity. In that, if you're gullible, you'll keep on making friends with other people who are gullible and who will bother to hang around you. Like, your friends will be equally gullible because you are. Yeah. So this is a bit of an indictment. I'll post post this with a picture of the flower, HMS Sydney. Thanks a lot for listening. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.